Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. We were all saddened when Andy Griffith finally passed away, just as we were all saddened when Barney Fife, Don Knotts, I should say, passed away as well, because, of course, all of us are fans of the Andy Griffith Show. So I can think of no better team to introduce today's topic than Andy and Barney and Opie.
What's problem, Op?
History.
Oh, Opie, if it makes you feel any better, I never was much at history either.
Weren't you, Andy?
No.
Oh, that's funny. History was right up my alley.
Well, I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah. History was one of my best subjects.
It was?
Well, yeah, don't you believe me? Well, ask me something. Go ahead, ask me anything.
Okay, what was the Emancipation Proclamation?
You kidding? Everybody knows that.
Well, good. Don't be easy for you, then. Go ahead, tell us about it.
Oh, you're kidding. That's one of the most famous proclamations in history.
I know.
I'll bet you even Opie knows that one. Go on, tell him, Op. Tell him about the Emancipation Proclamation.
I never heard of it.
You never? I don't know what they're teaching them these days. You tell him, Aunt B.
Me? I wasn't there, Lansing.
Well, I guess it's up to you, Barn. Listen to this, Op, might learn something. Go ahead, Barn.
Well, the Emancipation Proclamation...
How do you like that? Spot right there on my uniform.
Guess I ought to be sending this out to the cleaners. Now, you was asking about the...
Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm all ears.
Yeah, you always was. Well, the Emancipation Proclamation was a proclamation is what it was.
What was it about?
About emancipation. What do you think it was about? What was it about? Use your head, man. It's common knowledge. There was these folks... And how else was they going to get themselves emancipated unless there was a proclamation? So they got themselves a proclamation, and they called it the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I'm surprised at you for not knowing that, Andy. And I'll tell you something else. I'm even more surprised that you think and I don't know about the Emancipation Proclamation.
We're still waiting for you to tell us about it.
Well, if you get so smart-alecky about it, maybe I'm not even going to tell you.
Well, if you're like Barney, and I think most of us probably are, you only have the vaguest of notions what that important document called the Emancipation Proclamation did. You might be tempted to say, well, it's how Lincoln freed the slaves, but even if that's true, and I'll give you a hint, it's not entirely true, even if that's true, did it ever occur to you to ask, how could a president do such a thing? And... what about that thing, the 13th Amendment? Why do we have that in the Constitution? Didn't that free the slaves? And if that freed the slaves, then what did the Emancipation Proclamation do? It all gets rather confusing, doesn't it? Well, fortunately, I have an expert with me today. Recently, I spoke to Paul Finkelman, a very distinguished professor of law from Albany Law School, who's written about all kinds of important things, from baseball to constitutional law to the Emancipation Proclamation. And I met him in one of my favorite places. I was at Montpelier. I was there to help with their online Bill of Rights course. So was Paul. We stayed together in the Constitutional Village. We had many interesting discussions. And one of them occurred right in the center of the Constitution. And I'm going to share that one with you today. Paul Finkelman on the Emancipation Proclamation. Well, Paul Finkelman, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's a delight.
It is delightful. Now tell me all about this Emancipation Proclamation that we've all heard about in history class, but which apparently none of us really understands that well.
And probably none of us have read, or very few of you.
Probably very few, I would agree.
It's an incredibly boring document. And that's part of its
part of its genius.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start by explaining what Lincoln faces when he becomes president.
Yeah, let's put this in context.
7 states have declared they're no longer in the Union. They claim to be in a new country, which they call the Confederate States of America. Lincoln is being inaugurated. What he would like to do is avoid a civil war. What he would like is for these crazy people in these 7 states to come to their senses and come back to the United States. His inauguration is basically a lesson on the Constitution, a lesson on why secession is unconstitutional, and also a lesson on the limitations of presidential power, particularly regarding slavery. So he says in his first inaugural address, "I have no power to end slavery in the states where it exists." The Republican platform says we have no power to end slavery in the states where it exists. And what are you people worried about?
And he was holding out olive branches all over the place, wasn't he?
He's holding out olive branches. But what he will not compromise on is his belief that Congress has the power to ban slavery in federal territories, and that as president he will not support the expansion of slavery into the West. So on one hand, he is holding out a very clear, firm constitutional olive branch. I cannot touch slavery where it exists. The Constitution won't let me do this. And I have no inclination to touch it where it exists. Why does he have no inclination? Because he has no power. He doesn't believe the president can do whatever he wants without reading the Constitution.
Of course, the Southerners don't believe him, and the reason they're worried about westward expansion is they're worried about being outnumbered and outvoted down the road.
Well, they are, but many Southerners, including Virginians at least at that point, fully understand that slavery is probably safer in the Union than outside the Union.
Mm-hmm.
Think about this for a moment. It takes 3/4 of the states to pass a constitutional amendment. In 1860, there are 15 slave states. If there is no civil war to this day in 2012, those 15 slave states could block a constitutional amendment to end slavery.
Wow.
It would take a union of 60 states, 45 free states, to outvote the 15 slave states in a constitutional amendment.
Very interesting. But they, again, they didn't believe him, or they weren't comfortable with this. And in fact, by the time he was inaugurated in early March, how many states had already seceded?
7.
7 had already by that time.
That's right. Starting with South Carolina in December 1860. Now, those states simply want out.
Mm-hmm.
The people of South Carolina, at least the politicians, have been talking about leaving for a very long time. They tried to nullify a tariff under Andrew Jackson, and Jackson, of course, said, if necessary, I will personally hang the governor of South Carolina. And that ended that. There is a reason, by the way, when you see the famous painting of Lincoln reading the Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet. If you look at that painting very carefully, there is a painting of Andrew Jackson on the wall.
In the background, because Andrew, he stood up for the Union back in 1832,
right.
Wasn't it?
32, 33.
And right.
Jackson, of course, is a slaveholder.
Right.
He's a Southerner. But from Lincoln's perspective, he's a hero because he stood up to South Carolina. He stood for unionism. The Lincoln administration is saying, we're going to be just like Andrew Jackson. We will be tough on these traitors, these people who are trampling on the flag, trampling on the Constitution. We will be tough on them. But in his inauguration, he says, come back. I can't do anything to harm you.
Right.
And this frustrates the Deep South no end.
Mm-hmm.
The South Carolinians are beside themselves. What they want is for Lincoln to make war. And Lincoln says, I will not make war. I won't send troops. I won't do anything. And all he tries to do is to send food to the troops at Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor. And South Carolina uses that as the excuse to bombard Fort Sumter and start the war. That brings Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas, the sort of the northern belt of the Confederacy, into the Confederacy. Now, the war begins.
Right.
Lincoln believes it will be a short war. He doesn't really think it's going to be a war. He, again, foolishly or mistakenly believes the Southerners will stop this nonsense and come back. And so for the first couple of months of the war, he does nothing about slavery, even though everybody understands slavery is the cause of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And
before you go on, Paul, now that's just it. I mean, on the one hand, we can look back with the benefit of hindsight, and you know, the Civil War is a fact. It's a huge historical fact. But that really must have been something that really shook up somebody like Lincoln or anybody else who cared about the Union. The very idea that people were actually going to go through with this, that they were, you know, they'd been threatening secession for at least 20, 30 years, but the fact that they would actually finally do it, that probably was difficult to swallow.
The first secession threat is in 1776.
Well,
the Continental Congress is debating a taxation policy.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, taxation is going to be based on population. So much taxes per person living in your state. And the South Carolinians essentially say, if you tax our slaves, we're out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So from the very beginning, they're uncomfortable about it. There have been lots of secession threats.
Mm-hmm.
But Lincoln doesn't believe it.
Right. Finally, they went through it. It's kind of like crying wolf all those times.
That's right.
Okay. So
the war begins.
So he's shocked. The war begins.
Slavery has caused a secession. Southerners don't like to talk about this. They don't want to think that their ancestors left the Union to preserve slavery. What they need to do is read the declarations of the causes of secession issued by Texas, South Carolina, Georgia, and Mississippi.
It is all right there.
It's all right there.
It's all right there.
We are leaving. Texas says we will never give up slavery. Slavery exists forever. Mississippi says slavery is the greatest material interest in the world. South Carolina goes on and on and on about we are leaving because Northerners believe not only in that slavery is wrong, they believe in racial equality. Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, gives a speech a month before the war starts in which he says the cornerstone of the Confederacy is the belief in Negro inequality. That's the language he uses, that they mm-hmm. are inferior to us and that their only place is as slaves. He says the cornerstone of the Confederacy is racial inferiority and slavery combined. Now, you will often meet Southerners. I had a student who said, look, you know, my ancestors fought in the, you know, whatever it is, North Carolina infantry. They didn't own slaves. Why were they doing that? Well,
not everybody who is on fighting on one side or the other is going to be a slave owner, or is going to have exactly the same reasons for fighting.
I'm sure if you asked the guys landing in D-Day in Normandy, why are you here, they would have almost universally said the same thing. I got drafted. I got conscripted. They wouldn't say, oh, I'm here to fight fascist totalitarianism in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
The guy in the foxhole is there because he was put there. But the leadership, the officers, the generals, the political leaders know exactly why they're doing. And we also underestimate the Southern commitment and the Southern involvement in slavery. More than half of the white families in Mississippi and South Carolina are slaveholding families. That is more than 50% of every family. Now, that doesn't mean 50% of all Southern whites own slaves in South Carolina, because a family, the father may own slaves, the children don't own them yet. In addition, a significant number of non-slaveholders rent slaves. They are overseers. They borrow slaves. If your barn burns down, the rich planter down the road sends a handful of slaves over to help you rebuild your barn. Southern whites are almost universally connected to slavery, except in those parts of the South where they're almost all slaves, like Appalachia, where this radio program is being broadcast
from. Mm-hmm.
But in the rest of the South, the commitment to slavery is overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes ask my students when they say, you know, why would non-Southern whites own slaves? I say, how many of you believe in home ownership? And they all raise their hand. And then I say, how many of you
own actually own homes, right?
And two hands go up. And I say, well, what about the rest of you? Why do you believe in home ownership if you don't own a home? And they all say, well, we hope to own a home, or our father owns a home. I said, welcome to the antebellum South.
Mm-hmm.
Because what does a non-slaveholder want to be? He wants to be a slave owner. So they secede to protect slavery.
Right. And so slavery is at the root of all this. And so the question of slavery is going to have to be resolved one way or the other through this conflict or after this conflict.
And, of course, immediately, blacks in the North say free the slaves. Frederick Douglass says the slaves are the backbone of the Confederacy. He's right. All of those slaves producing all that food, working in the iron mills, working in the Tredegar iron factory, working in the mines, producing cannon, producing wagons, driving wagons. Slaves don't fight for the Confederate Army. There's this weird myth of Confederate slaves. There aren't any slaves in the Confederate Army. There aren't any blacks in the Confederate Army. But there are lots of slaves with the Army because masters bring their slaves to work for the Army. So all that labor is vital. But Lincoln won't touch slavery because of four reasons. First, he needs to preserve the four loyal slave states.
Right, people often forget that not all the slave states seceded.
Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri do not secede. And the reason they don't secede is because they understand that slavery is pretty well protected by the United States. They are the ones who suffer from runaway slaves. South Carolina, it's very hard for a slave to escape Georgia or South Carolina or Mississippi. But they escape from Kentucky and Maryland. They run north, and they get a fair number of them back. They don't get them all back, but they get a fair number of them back. Mm-hmm. They understand if they leave the Union, the fugitive slave law doesn't apply anymore. Mm-hmm. They can't get them back. So it's interesting that the places which are most threatened by Northern anti-slavery are the ones that remain in the Union. So Lincoln's first call is make sure these four states don't leave. Early on in the war, a group of ministers come to Lincoln. They say, if you free the slaves, you'll have God on your side. And Lincoln allegedly said, and he probably did say it because it's the kind of thing he'd say, he said, I'd like to have God on my side. I need Kentucky.
That's a great quote. It's really true. And if you think about it, look at geography. So much of the war was fought right in the area between the two capitals, mm-hmm. between Washington, D.C., and between Richmond. Eventually, it was Richmond in the South. And, I mean, Lincoln did not have a good geographical position to have his capital city to begin with, and he had slave states all around him his rear. He had to be concerned about the loyalties there.
And imagine a Confederate army on the southern bank of the Ohio River.
Oh, yeah.
So Lincoln has to preserve Kentucky. That's his first task. His second task is he has to make sure that he has a constitutional theory under which he could free slaves. Constitution protects private property.
Yep.
The Supreme Court has said slaves are private property.
Dred Scott.
Lincoln understands slaves are private property. Lincoln says we have no power to end slavery in this
state. I'll just add this to that, Paul, and correct me if I'm wrong. They're not just private property. They're the most important private property in the Southern economy. I mean, along with land itself.
The sum total value of all the slaves in 1860 is the second largest, most valuable form of private property in the U.S. after land.
I mean, so that we weren't just talking about taking away some small items or some baubles here and there. We were talking about essentially undercutting the entire Southern economy by freeing slaves. Now, I'm not defending slavery. I'm simply saying from their perspective, the Constitution protects our property. That's what the Supreme Court has said.
That's
and
right.
You cannot take that away without compensating us, according to the Fifth Amendment.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. The sum total value of all the slaves is worth more than all of the railroads in the United States combined.
Wow.
All of the corporations in the United States combined. All of the banks in the United States are not worth as much as all of the slaves in the South.
Okay. Now we understand at least the economic motives operating.
The economic motives is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
The constitutional issue is that the Constitution protects slavery. The Constitution provides special protections for slavery over and above merely the Fifth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln understands this. So in order to go after slavery, he has to have some idea that there's a constitutional theory that will allow him to do it. Third thing he has to have is support of the Northern politicians, the Northern people. Lincoln may have won the election, but Douglas did very well in a number of states.
Mm-hmm.
And it's conceivable in 1864 a president who is against emancipation might win unless there's popular support for emancipation. So you have to have political support. The fourth thing...
Before you go on with that one, yes, the Civil War was ultimately about slavery, but it doesn't mean everybody in the North was an abolitionist and everybody in the South was an ardent slaveholder.
That's right.
There was a lot of difference of opinion with regard to the institution of slavery in the North, and there were a lot of Northerners who were not at all interested in fighting to emancipate slaves.
Huge numbers.
Right.
There's an asymmetry in the war. That is, slavery is the cause of secession. Slavery is the reason the South leaves. Slavery is the reason the South is willing to go to war with the United States. But unionism is the reason the North begins the war.
Right.
Most Northerners are not seeing this as a crusade against slavery, although probably the majority of Northerners fully understand slavery is the cause of the war.
Right.
They are seeing this as preserving the Constitution, preserving the United States. This is an act of patriotism. This is a response to the anger they feel because the Southerners have abandoned the country.
Right.
So that's the asymmetry. So Lincoln has to have Northern support for emancipation. The fourth thing he has to have, which is something most people don't understand, is he has to have a reasonable chance of winning the war.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking about the Emancipation Proclamation with Professor Paul Finkelman. It's a fascinating discussion, so stick around. After the break, we'll have our Constitutional quiz, and then we'll talk some more with Paul Finkelman.
Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
I hear the call of James Madison's Montpelier, just a squirrel's leap from heaven, calling, and in the person of our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael from the Center of the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. How are you, Kelly?
I am great, Stuart. So happy to be with you again.
Happy to have you with us. Now, of course, when you come here, we know we're about to have a quiz. Do you have a question ready for us?
Oh, I've got a great one today.
I've got a great one today. What does it deal with generally?
First Amendment. And
well,
free speech.
Free speech.
And
well,
press, so.
Well, we like to talk here, yeah. So I'm going to see, do we have a contestant to talk about the First Amendment?
Yes.
And who are you, sir?
This is Brad Park, and I am from Hindman, Kentucky.
Hindman, Kentucky. Do you know a lot about the First Amendment, Brad?
Trying to.
Trying
to brush up on it a little bit.
Well, a very important subject. Okay, Kelly, why don't you give Brad his question?
All right. Here we go. The First Amendment protections of free speech and press do not protect. Is it A, flag burning, false statements of fact, or opinion countervailing a common consensus of decency? B.
Okay, wait, that was a long one. So what was A? What was A again?
A is flag burning, false statements of fact, or opinions countervailing a common consensus of decency.
Okay, that's a whole bunch of stuff. Okay, what was B?
B, misleading political statements, pornography, or profane and deeply insulting speech.
Okay.
C, threats of violence, child pornography, or misleading commercial advertising.
All right, and what was D?
D, racist remarks, the promotion of radical Islam, or speech that threatens to undermine the most fundamental principles of American government.
Okay, so we have a list of things that are theoretically not protected by the First Amendment, and so we've got to find an answer choice that contains only those things that are unprotected, right?
That is correct.
So if we find a single protected type of speech in an answer choice, then we know that that answer choice is not the one we're looking
for.
That
is also correct.
Okay, you clear on that, Ryan? Or Brad. You're Brad. You're not Ryan.
Yeah,
I'm
Brad.
Sorry. I know a guy named Ryan.
Brad may have run for the hills on this question.
Yeah,
this is a tough one. I think I can narrow it down to A or C.
Well, let's go through it. No, we'll do them one by one. You tell us what you think. What is A again?
All right. A was flag burning, false statements of fact, or opinions countervailing a common consensus of decency.
Okay. Does the First Amendment protect any of those things, Brad?
I'm pretty sure it protects flag burning. Just from what I've heard in the media, but I do not think it protects the latter two.
Okay, but if it protects any of those, then that means it's not the answer choice we're looking for, right?
Okay,
so I guess we can take A off the table, or for at least tentatively. What was B, Kelly?
Misleading political statements, pornography, or profane and deeply insulting speech.
Is there anything in there that is protected by the First Amendment? What were they again, Kelly?
Misleading political statements, pornography, or profane and deeply insulting speech.
I believe all those are protected.
That's politically misleading.
Misleading political statements? Yeah. That never happens,
well,
right?
Well, if it's not protected, then I give say, yeah, well, we need to start prosecuting some people, I suppose. Okay, so that's apparently not the correct answer. What was C then?
C, threats of violence, child pornography, or misleading commercial advertising.
Is there anything that's protected by the First Amendment in that list, Brad?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, what were they again?
Threats of violence. Child pornography. Or misleading commercial advertising.
Okay, and you don't think any of those are protected by the First Amendment?
No.
Okay, so it looks like C is the front runner. Okay, but what's finally D?
Racist remarks, the promotion of radical Islam, or speech that threatens to undermine the most fundamental principles of American government.
Is there anything in there that's unprotected? I mean, does the Constitution protect things like racist remarks?
As far as I know, but I'm not really sure.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, we're getting down to go time. What do you think? Is it C, which you liked before, or is it that last one, D?
I'm going to go with C.
You're going to go with C. Okay, I'm looking at Kelly.
All right, congratulations, Brad.
Wow, congratulations. That was a tough one.
It's a very interesting question, but it's a tough one.
Yep. And you're right. Those three things that are in answer choice C are all things that are outside the protection of the First Amendment. And stated differently, it means the government can actually outlaw these things. It can outlaw misleading commercial stuff. I mean, that's why you have these consumer protection mm-hmm. bills. You can't claim that, you know, your laundry detergent does something it doesn't do.
Right.
And what were the other ones in C?
Child pornography.
Child porn. It's one of those mm-hmm. things that, you know, as problematic as any exception to the First Amendment is, that's one that people agree they're not going to protect. You can make that illegal, and it is very much illegal
Absolutely.
In all 50 states.
Yep.
And then what was the last part of C?
Threats of violence.
Yeah, threats. You can't threaten people. You can't actually threaten them in a way that makes them fearful. And a true threat is one of the few things that the First Amendment does not protect. Mm-hmm. Very important cross-burning case on that one, the Virginia versus Black, just a few years ago. Okay, Brett, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Well done,
Brad. I'm impressed.
Tough area of law and a tough question, but you got it, so you're going to get a T-shirt.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to Professor Paul Finkelman about Abraham Lincoln and the various thought processes that he went through before he issued the Emancipation Proclamation.
Historians, and I am a historian as well as a law professor, but
right.
many historians of the Civil War have misunderstood the mental chronology that leads to emancipation. They see Lincoln as emancipating the slaves because he's desperate for black soldiers. He needs a desperate move to save the nation. But in all of Lincoln's letters and all of his discussions of emancipation, from early spring 1861 until September 1862, when he issues the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, is that I can only emancipate the slaves when, as he says in one letter, I have a fair prospect of winning the war. Otherwise, he says, I will look foolish. And if I don't win the war, then emancipation means nothing.
Right, yeah.
Civil War historians tend to focus on Virginia. They tend to believe that Virginia is everything. And so they say, you know, the summer of 1862 is not a good time. McClellan's bogged down in Virginia, nothing's happening, they're not making any headway against Virginia. But what they forget is that from late 1861 until September 1862, the United States scores enormous victories elsewhere. Captures Memphis.
Right, along the
captures
Mississippi.
Captures Nashville, the first Confederate capital to fall. Captures Little Rock, the second Confederate capital. Captures Baton Rouge and then Little Rock. Three Confederate state capitals fall. The Confederates are pushed out of Missouri and mostly out of Arkansas, with the result that Missouri is secured for the Union. General Grant, in a brilliant 10 days, captures Fort Henry and Fort Donelson mm-hmm. on the Cumberland and the Tennessee rivers and pushes. And so instead of the Confederates threatening to take Kentucky, in fact, the United States can now move into Tennessee and seize Memphis and Nashville. New Orleans falls, the biggest city in the Confederacy. The U.S. lands troops and secures the sea islands off the coast of South Carolina and Georgia. The Confederacy, in other words, is shrinking, not growing. And Lincoln is winning in the West, and he's winning along the seacoast. He's basically shut off every southern port but one. And these are substantial victories. The final one, of course, is at Antietam, where Lee invades Maryland. Lee gets clobbered at Antietam. Again, historians say, well, you know, it's a tie. It's not a tie. Lee leaves the battlefield. Lee leaves the battlefield with enormous casualties, casualties which he can't afford, casualties which will be hard to replace. He leaves cannon and guns and gunpowder, which will be hard to replace. It's a devastating loss for Lee. More importantly, it's a political and psychological loss, because Lee foolishly believes that when he marches into Maryland, the slave owners in Maryland will welcome the Confederate Army. They don't. They throw garbage, rotten tomatoes at the Confederate Army. Mm. They close their shutters when the Confederate Army marches through town. They see these Confederates by 1862 as invaders. And so it is after Antietam that he feels secure to issue the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation.
Okay, the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. Let's define that. What do you mean by the Preliminary Emancipation?
Well, what he says is, in 100 days I will free the slaves.
Okay, so he's predicting
if you don't come back. Now, let me backtrack and explain the constitutional and political issues.
Please.
The first issue, Missouri and Kentucky, very simple. Early in the war, the U.S. general in Missouri, John C. Fremont, orders an emancipation of the slaves in Missouri. Lincoln countermands it. Lincoln says, you cannot do this.
Most people have no idea about that.
Yeah,
they have no idea about that, but he just exceeded his authority. He was jumping the gun.
And Missouri is still in the United States, so you can't take property away from U.S. citizens.
Right.
Lincoln deals very cagely and carefully with Kentucky. He does not send an army into Kentucky until the Confederates invade Kentucky.
He's not there occupying Kentucky. He's there defending Kentucky.
That's right.
Again, that is very cagey, right?
Very, very cagey. And, of course, Grant's great victories just south of Kentucky in northern Tennessee secure Kentucky. The governor of Kentucky then heads off for the Confederacy because he's a secessionist.
Hmm.
Maryland is secured. And so by the spring of 1862, Missouri, Delaware, Maryland are secured. By the fall of 1862, Kentucky is firmly secured as well. Lincoln's got that. Constitutional problem is more difficult. How do you free the slaves when the Constitution protects property? Well, in Virginia, the process starts. Fortress Monroe, not too far from Washington, D.C., is a U.S. Army fort.
Still is.
Still is. And Fortress Monroe is under the command of General Benjamin F. Butler. Now, Benjamin Butler is not a great general. He's what we call a political general. He got his job because of politics. Before the war, he was a Democrat. The Democrats are the party of the South, pro-slavery.
Right.
Butler has never shown any interest in slavery. But as soon as the war begins, he becomes a major general. He's a lawyer before the war. And he's really a very good lawyer. He's not that good a military tactician, but he's a great lawyer. And at Fortress Monroe, he needs to be a great lawyer. In May 1861, probably the most bizarre, surrealistic event of the war takes place. A major named M.B. Carey comes in full dress uniform with a white flag, comes to Fortress Monroe, and says, I'm here on behalf of my colonel, Colonel Mallory. Three of his slaves have escaped to Fortress Monroe. I'm here to get them back under the fugitive slave law.
No way! The Confederates show up and seek to invoke the United States Constitution when they have already seceded.
And Butler tells him, come back tomorrow. We'll talk about this. He spends all night reading not military books, but law books. Guy comes back the next day and Butler says that these three slaves were used to build fortifications for your army. Therefore, they are contrabands of war. And as contrabands of war, I cannot give them back to you any more than he would give back a cannon or a rifle or a horse or a wagon.
And that goes back to exactly how we started this conversation. The slaves were an enormous asset, not just economically, but directly supporting the Confederate war effort.
That's right. They're a military asset.
And that was his theory. You're a military asset. We've captured that asset. The asset escaped to us, but now we control it and we're not giving it back.
Now.
Okay, that's an interesting theory.
And what Butler says is the fugitive slave law does not apply to a foreign country as Virginia pretends to be.
Right.
And he says one of the inconveniences of secession is that you're going to have to live with this, because for this moment we'll take you at your word. He then says, however, if Colonel Mallory will come to Fortress Monroe and swear an oath of allegiance to the United States Constitution and take off his Confederate uniform, he could have his slaves back. Colonel Mallory doesn't.
I have to laugh at that. I mean, that is such a lawyerly response. Yeah. And oh my goodness.
Colonel Mallory doesn't show up. But Lincoln now has his constitutional theory, which is basically this. He cannot, as president of the United States, emancipate the slaves, however much he'd like to. He hates slavery. Mm-hmm. He always hated slavery.
Right.
At one point he says, I am naturally anti-slavery. Being naturally anti-slavery is interesting. He doesn't have to read an abolitionist tract to understand slavery is wrong. He simply has to see slavery once. I am naturally anti-slavery. He says, in another letter, he says, if slavery is not wrong, then nothing is wrong.
Very pithy.
But,
which is, of course, why the Confederates didn't trust him.
That's right. But he also understands his constitutional limitations. Mm-hmm. As president, he can't touch slavery. But as commander-in-chief of the armies and navies, in time of actual rebellion, he finds the power to emancipate slaves because they are being used for the war effort. And so Butler's contraband theory, which frees three slaves in May, ends up being used to free thousands of slaves.
Well, before we get there, what was the date of this incident at Fort Monroe?
It's mid-May, 1861.
Mid-May, 1861, so this is early in the war.
It's early in the war.
Did Lincoln actually get the theory from him, or is it something he'd already been considering? Is there any record of it?
I do not know.
Okay.
What we do know is that Butler, of course, sends a report. That's why we had to know exactly what happened, because Butler sends a report to the commanding generals in Washington saying, this is what I did. And by August, the Secretary of War has issued a memorandum saying that commanders are hereby authorized to follow Butler's precedent.
This is remarkable, and this is so important. This is actually a modern issue. It's an issue that's still with us today. The president's power under Article II as commander-in-chief is an extremely important power, and in some sense it's enhanced when an actual war is on, because that's when the president is acting directly, unquestionably, as commander-in-chief. And, of course, it's like all constitutional powers, it's subject to interpretation. And here he has an interpretation that's come up the chain of command, emerging from the crucible of war itself, an actual incident. It's going to be repeated. They know it's going to be repeated. And so he says, I'm commander-in-chief. I'm authorizing you to do this because it's part of prosecuting the war.
By the way, it's significant that Lincoln does not believe the emancipation process in this method applies to the loyal slave states, because they're in the Union.
Right, they're in the Union. So he's able to preserve the Fifth Amendment for those who are staying in the Union.
And so if you want to use the modern analogy, the war powers of the president overseas are very different than what the war powers would have in the United States itself.
Mm-hmm.
We saw this after 9/11. I mean, this is the obvious.
No, Paul, I got to stop you. That's a whole nother subject, and we'll have to talk about that.
Well, I just want to give you the one quick analogy.
Okay.
The obvious analogy is this. Right after 9/11, President Bush said things, and members of his cabinet said things like, the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to terrorists in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as it turns out, it does. Why? Because they're in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so whatever one thinks about Guantanamo or Afghanistan or Iraq, clearly, the president's powers overseas, where there's actually a war going on, are very different than they are in the United States, where there's not a war going on. And Lincoln makes this very clear in every one of his proclamations.
We sometimes forget that James and Dolly Madison's lives were not all about politics and constitutional law. Sometimes they were concerned with even greater forces. For example, when they were reminded that their home, Montpelier, lies squarely within the Central Virginia seismic zone. In 1774, Virginia statesman John Blair wrote to Thomas Jefferson that on February 21st in Williamsburg, at about 2 in the afternoon, we had a very moderate trembling of the earth, so moderate that not many perceived it. But Dr. George Gilmer informs me it was a pretty smart shock with you, and by all accounts it was more and more severe as you advanced to the west. These tremors, which Jefferson noted in his account book, on February 21st and 22nd, 1774, were undoubtedly also felt at Montpelier, although no extant accounts exist. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
So, welcome, Christian Coates, to your weekly constitutional. And who are you and what do you do at Montpelier?
Thanks, Stuart. My name is Christian Coates. I'm the Director of Education and Visitor Engagement. We started a number of new tours for the spring of 2012. Every other Saturday, every even Saturday throughout the summer, we're offering the Journey from Slavery to Freedom at 1 o'clock. It's a 90-minute tour. One of the great things about Montpelier is that we have sites at Montpelier that cover the entire breadth of U.S. history. So this Journey from Slavery to Freedom goes to a number of different historic sites on the property and looks at the journey African Americans have taken, you know, from the period of slavery through the Civil Rights era, mm-hmm. really through today. So we go, you know, to the enslaved sites around the mansion, mm-hmm. But then we also go to the Gilmore Cabin, which is the home of an emancipated slave after the Civil War, and we look at Reconstruction, mm-hmm. and we look at the beginnings of Jim Crow. And then we go to the 1910 segregated train depot on the other side of Route 20, and we talk about the Jim Crow era, we talk about civil rights, and the progress to today.
Well, that sounds fascinating.
It's a great tour.
When is that, this summer?
It's every other Saturday. It's a 90-minute tour. It's only an extra $5 on top of your admission ticket. It's mm-hmm. well worth the time. Every odd Saturday, the first and third Saturdays of every month, and also every Sunday at 1 o'clock, we offer the enslaved community tour. So that's more focused just on the period of slavery, and it's just around the house. It's a 60-minute tour. Also a $5 charge.
Well, thanks to Christian Coates for telling us what's happening this week at Montpelier. Now let's finish our discussion with Professor Paul Finkelman, who's explaining to us all about the Emancipation Proclamation.
So the Emancipation Proclamation only applies to the Confederate states that are still at war with the United States.
And that's why it's the president doing it with the stroke of a pen rather than an act of Congress, rather than an amendment to the Constitution. And no one understands it. How could a president do something so momentous because he's commander-in-chief?
It's the commander-in-chief of the armies doing it, not the president.
Oh, okay. Well, go on. Please explain
that. The Emancipation Proclamation will begin, I, Abraham Lincoln, commander-in-chief of the United States Army and Navy in time of actual rebellion.
Wow.
He also says he's president.
Right.
But the point is that this is the inherent power of the commander-in-chief to take away the tools of war from the enemy.
Okay.
All right. So Butler's policy will lead to that. So one question that people ask is, you know, why does Lincoln wait until September 1862 to issue the preliminary proclamation, or until January 1863 to issue the final proclamation, or to put it another way, why does he wait so long to end slavery? And the answer is, he, through his subordinates, the generals, begin to end slavery in May 1861.
Wow.
And
no one has any idea about that now, I don't think, or very few people do.
So starting in May 1861, you begin to get the gradual ending of slavery by the army. And the army becomes the tool of emancipation. Slaves begin to run away to U.S. Army lines, and when they get inside U.S. Army lines, they are free. Now, the contraband thing is fascinating, mm-hmm. because somebody starts as a slave. As one foot enters a U.S. Army line, he becomes a contraband, or she becomes a contraband, because lots of slave women are escaping too. Mm-hmm. When 2 feet are in the U.S. Army lines, they're no longer property, so they're no longer contrabands. They are now free persons, and free people need jobs. Mm-hmm. And so the army employs them. Probably by...
They become camp followers of the Union Army?
They're not camp followers. They're civilian employees of the army.
Wow.
Dressed in blue uniforms because it's the only thing the army has to dress them in.
Hmm.
And what do? They do everything soldiers do except go to the front lines and fight. They drive wagons. They are work in hospitals. They are in burial details. They are cooks. They are seamstresses. They are laborers. They build fortifications. And, of course, when attacked, they probably pick up guns and shoot back.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're not soldiers, they're still defending themselves. So by the end of 1862, there are probably 100,000 blacks in uniform working in the army, working with the army, but they are not in the army.
Augmenting the Union army, yeah. Wow.
Meanwhile, there are another 20,000 or so blacks in the Navy, and they are legally in the Navy because the laws governing the military, while the laws don't allow for the enlistment of blacks in the army, it does allow for having blacks in the Navy. So there are probably 20,000 sailors, and they're real sailors. They're in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot of black support, and this is the beginning of the end. What Lincoln will do in the Emancipation Proclamation is essentially say, what General Butler can do to 3 slaves, I can do to 3 million slaves.
Wow.
All right. So that's the Constitutional Lincoln. And if you think how the war ends, how does the war end? Well, the war ends with Grant and Lee slaughtering each other
mm-hmm.
on what's essentially the I-95 corridor and in west of I-95. And meanwhile, General Sherman marches from Vicksburg all the way to Charleston on the coast and then up the coast into North Carolina. So basically, if Lee had not been caught at Appomattox, if Lee had continued to fight, eventually what Lee would have found is that while Grant's coming at him from the front, Sherman would be coming at him from the rear.
Right.
And he would have been slapped between the two of them. So that's ultimately how the war will play out. But by the way, this is exactly how General Winfield Scott, the Virginia-born commander of the U.S. Army, at the beginning of the war, says it should take place. He says, strangle the Confederacy, take the Mississippi, and just squeeze it. And that's ultimately what happens. So to go back to Lincoln, he's got a constitutional theory, which he has to work out. He's got political issues. In April 1862, the Congress ends slavery in the District of Columbia through compensated emancipation. They give $300 to every slave owner.
Okay, say that again, because I think most
people...
Okay,
in April 1862, Congress passes a law ending slavery in the District of Columbia.
Okay, so that's done by just a congressional act.
Because Congress has full authority to regulate the District of Columbia under the Constitution.
Right.
The Constitution says that the Congress shall have complete authority to regulate a district not to exceed, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not to exceed 10 square miles as may, by cession of particular states and acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States.
Okay,
that's Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution.
But they did compensate the slave owners.
They compensated because the Fifth Amendment says you can't
take property. Required them to, okay, good.
They give them $300. Slave owners complain, hey, my slave was worth $1,000. Clearly, there's a bear market on slaves in 1862 in the District of Columbia. Take what you can get.
Right.
They end slavery in the District of Columbia. Congress does. Lincoln signs it. That's the beginning of the end. A month or so later, Congress ends slavery in the territories, this time without compensation. Just say, we have a right to regulate the federal territories. No more slavery. This contradicts Dred Scott, because Chief Justice Taney said, you can't take slaves away from people in the territories. Congress says, we're ignoring the Chief Justice, we're going to do it.
Okay, now that's huge too, okay, because in Dred Scott decision, that was 1856? 1857, a huge decision leading up to the Civil War. The Supreme Court did several things, but one of them, as you said, was to say, in these territories where there's so much controversy, you cannot take slaves because it'd be a violation of the Fifth Amendment. So Congress basically is saying, is thumbing their nose at the Supreme Court at this point.
That's right.
Okay, all right.
And there are constitutional reasons for that. If you remember the Dred Scott case, the first thing Chief Justice Taney says is Dred Scott cannot sue in federal court because blacks can't be citizens of the United States. The position of the Republican Party of Lincoln, the anti-slavery position, is this. If Dred Scott can't sue, then there is no case before the Supreme Court.
There was no jurisdiction.
There's no jurisdiction.
So everything else was dictum.
Everything else was dictum. Everything else has no more validity, as one newspaper editor put it, than the rantings of nine men standing around a bar in Washington, D.C. It is not law because Tawney says I have no jurisdiction.
Okay, let me just clarify that for our non-lawyer listeners. Is if a court has no subject matter jurisdiction, okay, a federal court, it cannot hear a certain type of case. We like to say that the case, it was like it never happened, okay?
That's right.
And that's actually one of the many curious things about Dred Scott is that if Chief Justice Taney and the court in 1857 had stopped there, it would have been a much less momentous decision.
Nobody would remember it.
But probably not much. But they went beyond that and invalidated the Missouri Compromise.
That's right.
And that was always something that we lawyers like to call dictum. That is, the court speaking out of turn, nothing more than the rantings of nine guys in a bar. So there was a constitutional basis for questioning that part of the Dred Scott decision. But again, given the concept of judicial review and that the Supreme Court is generally considered to be the final authority, this was still Congress slapping the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. They're slapping the Supreme Court. They're slapping Chief Justice Taney.
Okay.
But from Lincoln's perspective, these two laws mean something very different. What they mean is he has political support for emancipation.
Yeah.
He knows, you know, you don't have opinion polls. You can't do a telephone survey. You can't do Twitter in 1862.
Mm-hmm.
But he knows that members of Congress have a feel for the pulse of their districts. And if they're voting to end slavery in the territories and in D.C., that means the people back home support it.
Right.
Then in July 1862, Congress passes a resolution, not a law, it's a resolution saying that if the loyal slave states will emancipate their slaves, Congress will appropriate money for compensation for the owners.
So it's an offer.
It's an offer from Congress. If Kentucky will free its 200,000 slaves, a lot of slaves in Kentucky, then we will pay the masters. Lincoln calls in all the members of Congress from Kentucky, Delaware, Maryland, and Missouri. And he says, take this offer. Take what you can get. He says in this conversation that if you don't take this, then the abrasion and friction of war will take your slaves from you and you'll have nothing to show for it.
They must have been concerned about that.
Take Congress's offer. And he believes that these members of Congress, most of whom are Democrats, they hate Lincoln,
mm-hmm.
are going to be smart enough to go back to their state legislatures and say, look, we got a pretty good deal. We better take what we can get now. Instead, about 80% of them, 2 days later, published a letter in a newspaper denouncing Lincoln, denouncing compensation, to say, we will never give up slavery. And that's when Lincoln starts to draft the Emancipation Proclamation, because now he knows compensation won't work in the loyal slave states. He also knows that the loyal slave states can't secede. It's way too far gone for that. Mm-hmm. The army is too secure. The Confederates have been pushed too far south. Where's Missouri going to go? Where's Kentucky going to go?
So despite this rebuff from these slave-holding Union states, Lincoln feels strong enough at point to say, well, then the heck with you. You didn't take my offer, then
now,
I'm moving forward.
So he drafts the Emancipation Proclamation. He shows it to a couple of cabinet members. He then has a cabinet meeting where he shows it to everybody. And the cabinet unanimously says, yes, let's do it. The question is when. One of the members of the cabinet who is from Maryland says we should wait till after the next election. Says you're going to get killed in the 1862 off year election.
At least in those states.
Yeah, okay. A couple of others suggest we should wait till we have a big military victory in the East,
mm-hmm.
where people are going to notice it.
Mm-hmm.
So from early August until September 22nd or 23rd, when the preliminary proclamation is released, Lincoln cagily doesn't show his hand. At one point, the editor-in-chief of the New York Tribune, which is a Republican paper, writes an editorial called A Plea from 20 Million, in which he prays Lincoln free the slaves. Lincoln responds with a letter to the editor. It's probably the only time a president's ever written a letter to the editor to a newspaper. He says in the letter, I have only one goal, which is to preserve the Union. If I can preserve the Union by freeing no slaves, I will do that. If I can preserve the Union by freeing some of the slaves and leaving other slaves, I will do that. If I can preserve the Union by freeing all the slaves, I will do that. My only goal is to preserve the Union. Now, what's fascinating about this letter is he's already written the proclamation. It's in his desk.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, he's been freeing slaves for about 13 months now, or 14 months, since May 1861. It's August, so it's 16 months. 15 months. He's already been freeing slaves. So two pieces of the letter are clearly not even valid anymore.
That's one of the things people forget. You know, we have this mythology of Honest Abe, and he is this symbol of absolute rectitude and truthfulness. People forget what a politician he was.
Look, he's not saying anything dishonest in this letter.
I'm not saying he's dishonest. I'm simply saying that this is not exactly based on the facts.
No, what he is doing is preparing the North for what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially his response is directed only one segment to the North. Northern white conservatives who are afraid of emancipation, who are afraid of free black people, who were Democrats before the war, may still be Democrats. Some very conservative Republicans who hated the Democrats and so they became Republicans, but they're not really anti-slavery. And he's saying, look, you guys, I'm giving the South every chance it gets. But I'm warning you, it's coming. I'm going to do it. It will happen.
All right.
Okay. A couple of weeks later, early September, he has a meeting with a group of ministers from Chicago, and they beg him to free the slaves. And he says, I can't free the slaves until I have secured Kentucky. He says, otherwise I will take 50,000 bayonets out of the U.S. Army and put it in the Confederate Army. He's already secured Kentucky. He knows that. But this is his position. You know, I can't do this until I've secured Kentucky. And then he says, and I can't do this until I know I'm going to win the war, because otherwise I will be like the Pope who issued a papal bull against the comet. A week later, Antietam takes place. A couple of days later, he issues the preliminary proclamation in which he says, in 100 days, which will be January 1st. I'm convinced, by the way, that if he had done it 25 days later, it would be in 75 days. I am going to free the slaves. And on January 1st, he frees the slaves in all of those places that are still at war with the United States. Now, the critics of Lincoln say, well, he frees the slaves where he has no power to do so. But the answer to that, he frees the slaves where he has constitutional power. Keep in mind that in front of Sherman's army is an invisible banner, essentially, which says all people who come behind this army are free.
Mm-hmm.
And Sherman's march to the sea, from Vicksburg to Atlanta to Columbia, South Carolina to Charleston, is the greatest liberation of human beings in the history of the world.
On the first day of January, in the year of our Lord, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then, thenceforward, and forever free.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Professor Paul Finkelman of the Albany Law School for sharing with us all of those fascinating facts about the Emancipation Proclamation, what it did, how it happened, how it was constitutional. Thanks also to our executive producer, Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.